All right, so we're going to go back to Drosophila now. And by now, you guys are really familiar with this structure, which is the Drosophila ovary, right? And you've heard already a lot from Trudy Schupbach and looked at these things in the microscope and everything. And so, but I want to tell you about a few features of the morphogenesis of egg chambers and eggs that maybe you haven't already thought about. Because you've been thinking about the patterning processes that happen where localized RNAs and secreted proteins lead to localized activities within the egg to pattern things. But I want to tell you about a patterning event that I think is potentially purely mechanical in nature, and a symmetry breaking that isn't about gene expression patterns or localized proteins. But is really just about geometry and physical forces. And you guys can decide if this makes sense to you. And so, yeah, you don't have to worry about the lights. I think the light's coming from the door back there. And you're not going to have to see details
in there. I think it might
be. You can get rid of those? Okay.
Andy, it might be the other side, maybe.
So, and the feature I want to talk about for the next few minutes is really the fact that these egg chambers, which you're very familiar with now, right, are composed of the germline cells in the center and the follicle cells around the germline. They really start out round, but the eggs end up quite elongated, as you can see here. And this is a stage 9 egg chamber, and you can see that it's already elongated relative to this early stage egg chamber. And so how does that happen? How does that elongation happen? It's obviously important. Subsequently, the egg is going to be elongated. The fly is going to be elongated. Otherwise, we'd have round flies, right? And so this is a beautiful movie taken by David Builder's lab. And one of the things that you can immediately appreciate, and this was very fun to see, is that because we could only see this after we came up with the conditions where we could culture these organs outside of the adult fly, because this is not something you would ever imagine is happening if you look at fixed tissue. But here these egg chambers are rotating along their anterior-posterior axis. They, in fact, start these rotations very early as the egg chamber forms, probably as soon as the egg chamber forms. The rotations are slower at the beginning, so they're not as obvious, but you can already appreciate this one is rotating, this one's rotating. And you can also appreciate that they're not rotating all in one direction. It's random which direction they rotate in. It's not random with respect to dorsal, ventral, anterior, posterior. They only rotate around the anterior, posterior, but it's random whether they go leftward or rightward. So it turns out that this rotation is important for initiating the elongation of the egg chamber. And then I'm going to tell you about a mechanism that the other thing I want you to notice here is that these rotations actually stop. So this stage 10 egg chamber is not rotating, but this stage 6 egg chamber is rotating. So they stop at a certain point.
Excuse me, are they completely random? Because right now the smallest one is kind of clockwise, the next one is anti-clockwise, and then the next one is clockwise.
Yeah, I don't know. That would be worth looking into. It's possible that you would need to, otherwise you might build up some really weird tensions. So this follicle epithelium is that you see here, these epithelial cells surrounding the germline cells. They are apical basal polarized using the PAR complexes that you just heard about. And in fact, they're polarized such that the apical surfaces are pointing towards the germline because they're going to be secreting things in that direction. And then they have their basal surface in contact with an extracellular matrix that's surrounding this whole thing. And what Sally Horn has shown is that all these little follicle cells are crawling on the basement membrane like so many hamsters on a wheel, and that is facilitating this initial rotation. And so this rotating phase carries out the elongation, or is responsible for the elongation that you see from going from completely round to about this elongated. But then there's subsequently more elongation that happens, and what a former student in my lab showed is that at the stage where the rotations stop, something else happens, something new happens, that continues to facilitate the elongation of this structure. So here's this basement membrane that I told you about that's composed of collagen and laminin and that's surrounding this whole egg chamber. And the basal surfaces of these follicle cells are in contact with this basement membrane and are connected to it through integrin-based adhesions. And what you're looking at here is we're focusing top down onto the basal surfaces of these cells. And you're looking at the myosin light chain, which you've looked at a lot before already in embryos, as well as the focal adhesion protein paxillin. So these are the focal adhesions at either end, and myosin is accumulating and dissipating at this basal near this basal surface in a periodic manner, not synchronously in the cells, asynchronously, but in a periodic manner. And so my student Li Ho was able to measure these accumulations and show that they were happening on the basal surface of the cells, but not on the apical surface of the cells. And so this is just a heat map of the periodicity of the myosin intensity. And you can see that the intensity fluctuations are much greater near the basal surface and not so much near the apical surface. And he could show that that there was a periodicity to them, and on average they were oscillating around every 6 minutes. You'd get a peak intensity. And that in addition to myosin accumulating, the cell shape was changing. So, and the cell shape was changing directionally. So this is the dorsal ventral direction. Up and down is dorsal ventral, and my pointer is getting very weak, is dorsal ventral, and this is anterior posterior. And so the myosin is accumulating, contracting, and this is leading to a reduction in the area of the cell. And he could show that the myosin That the myosin accumulations were preceding the reduction in basal surface area. Okay, so, and that's just shown here where these are, here's the myosin accumulating, dissipating, and so on. Okay, and so we wanted to understand why the shape change was directional in this dorsal ventral area, and why it's happening near the basal surface. And the answer to both of those questions is simply that there are these stress fibers, actin stress fibers, that form near the basal surface. And the myosin is accumulating on those basal stress fibers. And if you get rid of the basal stress fibers, the myosin accumulations stop. And those stress fibers form and align along this dorsal ventral axis during the rotation. Okay, so during the rotation, as the follicle cells are crawling on the extracellular matrix in that, you know, crawling around the AP log axis, their crawling action tends to align the extracellular matrix fibers outside of the cell and the actin fibers inside of the cell. So this is a well-known phenomenon in like cultured cells, that if fibroblasts crawl on collagen, they align the collagen fibers along the migration path, and then the actin fibers, the stress fibers inside of the cell, line up along the extracellular matrix fibers. So that is what's going on in this tissue. And it's kind of cool because this was well established in vitro systems with just, you know, single cells migrating on cover slips coated with fibronectin. But here you can see it in a real tissue that's undergoing a real morphogenetic process. Okay, so the rotation both helps to elongate the egg chamber from the rotation itself, but also it creates this parallel arrays of actin stress fibers that are terminating in focal adhesions in red here at each end, and then that creates the substrate for these myosin oscillations. So it's interesting to sort of compare and contrast this with what you know, Eric has studied and Adam Martin have studied in the gastrulating embryo, where they see these apical oscillations, or what Thomas Lacouille was talking about in terms of apical accumulations of myosin. And so similarly, in both cases, you see an accumulation of myosin in a periodic manner, and this precedes some periodic change in shape. But there are some differences, and so you're all familiar with this, where the cells on the ventral surface of the embryo undergo these apical constrictions, and that leads to the internalization of those cells inside the embryo, and the idea of these medial actomyosin accumulations pulling in the edges of the cell and shrinking that apical surface. So it's interesting to think about that and compare and contrast it with the basal pulses that we're seeing, where the similarities are that they're periodic contractions, periodic myosin accumulation, and there's a cell shape change, but we're seeing it on the basal surface, not the apical surface. The actin organization is different because we have these parallel arrays of actin stress fibers, and they have these medial accumulations that don't seem, you know, that are not organized in one direction. And then the oscillations in the follicle cells are, in cell shape, are completely transient. So there's no equivalent to the ratchet in the apical constriction, right? The cell is ratcheting down its apical surface, and it's shrinking and shrinking and shrinking, and something is stabilizing the smaller area. Whereas in the follicle cells, this change in area is completely transient and completely reversed again. So when the cell relaxes, it goes back to its original shape. So you could say, well, what in the world is the point of that if all you're going to do is contract and then relax? Yes?
It also seems that a cool difference is that, yes, the actin is organized differently, but it's also a really stable organization for the actin. You always see something you think look like stress fibers there, and they're not getting reorganized by the myosin.
Right. That's right. And that's a function, I'll show you, of them being attached via those focal adhesions. They are attached at each end, and they are anchored into the extracellular matrix that they're attached to. So, and that's a function of them being at the basal surface rather than the apical surface, where you wouldn't have that attachment to the basement membrane.
So I find also that one great difference is that these contractile units at the basal side, they seem separated one from the other. There's this black region. You will not find apical in this constrictive cell. So what is exactly around this?
Okay. So you mean they don't seem to go to the very edge of the cell?
Well, they're not connected to one another. They're really not here, the one from the basal.
No, they're not connected to one another. And that, I think that's what... So these cells are also not acting in unison, whereas in the ventral furrow, the cells are just sort of this whole group of cells that are more or less contracting kind of together. So the space between, there's not actually space between the cells. So the cells, their cell membranes are touching each other, and they're connected through echadherin-mediated cell-cell junctions. I guess what this means is that the anchoring points, the focal adhesions, are not at the very edge of the cell. They're somewhat short of the edge of the cell.
What strikes me is here the period. You said, if I'm not mistaken,
six minutes.
And right. Everything I've heard about actomyosin pulses so far is about a minute and a half.
Right. So I think this is also a consequence of them being anchored into the extracellular matrix. And I'll show you that slows, that connection slows the period. And if we make that connection stronger, we can slow it down more. And if we make that connection weaker, we can speed up the period. And so at the apical surface, they're not anchored into the outside. They're not anchored to the outside of the cell. And so that must be the free running period of the actomyosin pulses.
So just going back to my point, do you see that the contraction in one basal side of one cell affects also the shape of the neighboring cell?
So they're connected to each other. So when one contracts, the other one stretches a little bit. But it's not a very, they're not exerting really strong, there's not a good correlation. There's a very minor anti-correlation between one cell contracting and the neighboring cells stretching. As far as we can tell, the distribution is pretty random. So, and so what do we think this is doing? We think that this is helping to elongate the egg chamber further, and that's why there's no need for a permanent change in cell shape. This is not something that's doing something to this particular cell. It's a force that this cell is creating that's exerting pressure on the underlying germline and changing and therefore changing the shape of this whole egg chamber. So these individual cells are not permanently changed by this activity. So the activity is not uniform in the whole group of follicle cells covering the egg chamber. It starts sort of near, at a particular stage in development after the rotations stop, and it starts in a subset of cells sort of near the center of this egg chamber, and then the number of cells exhibiting this oscillating myosin contractions grows and grows and grows until it's most of the cells. And so these are just some drug treatments. If we treat with cytochalasin, we see everything relax. So if you get rid of the actin cytoskeleton, if you treat with ionomycin, which is a calcium ionophore that then activates myosin, you see this uniform contraction. So we think, you know, it's actomyosin dependent, no big surprise. So this is our highly quantitative model for what we think is going on here. We're going to get a little more formal in a minute, but basically we think this is just like taking a round ball of dough, and in the initial phases you're rolling it by the rotation, and in the later phases you're squeezing it in the middle. And keep in mind that the whole volume of this whole thing is increasing as this egg chamber grows during the whole thing. And these two phases give you the final elongated shape. So we can make, we can't make these things completely mutant for any of the components that we think are important, because again, these are all essential genes. They're essential probably in every cell for life itself. But we can make big patches of mutant cells and ask what happens. And so we can see that if we make some of the follicle cells mutant for Rho kinase, we can get a round egg chamber, and we can quantify the AP to DV, you know, ratio. And if we make some of the follicle cells mutant for TALEN, which is one of the components in the focal adhesion complexes, we also can get round eggs. Or if we overexpress a focal adhesion component, in this case paxillin, we can see the focal adhesions get bigger, and we can actually hyper-elongate the egg chamber with that, which is sort of interesting because otherwise there's like not much phenotype associated with overexpressing paxillin. So, so the basal actin filaments are anchored to the extracellular matrix. Here's that extracellular matrix again, labeled in this case with collagen, through these focal adhesions, right? These focal adhesion complexes, which now are labeled in green in this image. And so you can see that all those stress fibers terminate at each end in those focal adhesions. And so we kind of can think of it this way, as the contractile stress fibers, and they're anchored into this extracellular matrix via these focal adhesion complexes composed of integrin, paxillin, TALEN, etc. So this is getting to that other question that now if we reduce the size of the focal adhesion by using a TALEN RNAi, then we can reduce both the amplitude and the period of the oscillations. So the wild-type oscillations are shown in red here, and then here's if we, and this is a partial reduction in the amount of TALEN because, again, it's sort of a lethal manipulation. Or if we overexpress paxillin here in green, we can increase both the magnitude and the period of those oscillations. So we think the period is set by the strength of this interaction with the extracellular matrix. This is kind of cool. This is what happens if you, so as I mentioned, this doesn't, these oscillations don't start uniformly in all the cells at the same time. They start initially in cells near the center of the egg chamber. And then I should also have to point out that during this period of time, there are some changes in cell shape that are happening. So the follicle cells that are covering the nerve cells here are starting to get really thin and flat. And the follicle cells, and so there's a gradual thinning of the follicle cell layer from here to here, the follicle cells over the nerve cells. And we can, we probably can't really ignore that, but we do kind of ignore that for the moment. But you can see the myosin is in red here, and you can just see it starting to accumulate in some of the cells here, and then you can see it more obviously here, and then you can see it obviously in most of the cells here. if we treat these egg chambers with collagenase to dissolve the extracellular matrix, you can actually see, and these are not the same egg chambers, right? This is a fixed image of an egg chamber, and this is a live image of treating with collagenase, but they are age matched, so the myosin should be in the same place. You can see that the effect it has on the overall shape of the egg chamber changes with increasing stage and correlates with where we see these myosin contractions. So what we can infer from this is that normally the attachment to the extracellular matrix is opposing the myosin contraction. And so now we've relieved that opposition, and now the myosin is free to contract, and this is creating now constrictions. I don't know how well you can see that. It's creating constrictions, and it's different exactly where those constrictions are happening depending on the stage and where the myosin happens to be accumulating at that time. So that's kind of interesting in terms of thinking about morphogenesis of tissues generally, that by opposing myosin and extracellular matrix, you could either have things expand uniformly or constrict, and I'll show you some examples where that might be interesting. And then if you just if you combine collagenase and latrunculin to prevent the actin cytoskeleton dynamics, then you can see that you don't get this constriction anymore, so it's clearly dependent on the presence of the actin cytoskeleton.
So the cells are also getting taller, right?
These cells are getting taller. Yes, they are. Well, what do you mean? When?
So it looks like the older egg chamber. The treatment with collagenase makes them taller. So I'm wondering why that is.
I don't think the cells are getting taller. I actually think it's just squeezing the yolk from the oocyte back towards the nerve cells, and then I don't think the cells are getting taller. Wait a minute, I haven't measured that, so. Yeah, I don't think so. I think it's just squeezing the oocyte cytoplasm towards the nerve cells, which makes us think that the normal function of all this myosin here is the opposite of that, right? Because the nerve cells are putting cytoplasm into the oocyte, and we think it's like they're catching it, so. Okay, so we can ask then, what is the oscillation mechanism, and why do some cells oscillate and others not, especially at the beginning, like what gets it started? And so here's where we got a little bit more formal and collaborated with Sean Sun, who's a mechanical engineer at Johns Hopkins, and he wrote a formal model to try to explain this. And so I'm not going to show you all of the equations in the model because they're his equations and I'm a biologist, but I will tell you conceptually what the underlying assumptions of the model are that seem to, when you put them together, seem to work. And that is that the initial, so first of all, there's a biochemical model in here that you're going to be familiar with, and that is that we have Rho activating Rho kinase, activating myosin light chain, and activating myosin. And we have that biochemical pathway under the control of stress coming from, I'll explain where I think the initiating stress is coming from, but it's been shown in cultured cells that you can activate this pathway in response to tension on the cells. And so those components are featured in this model, and there's a non-linear component to how tension on the cell is feeding into this pathway. And that's important for getting the oscillations that we see, at least in terms of modeling them. So where is the initial tension coming from? And in this case, it's quite different than in the case of the embryo. So the embryo is not growing when all the stuff that Eric and Thomas talked about is going on. The embryo is not growing, but the egg chamber is growing. And therefore, that growth is exerting an outward pressure on these cells. And so that's what Sean incorporated into the model, is the initial source of tension on these cells. And so the bigger the egg chamber gets, the more tension is going to be exerted. His model predicts that there will be oscillations in both myosin activity and in the cell length. And that there are there are, if the force is lower, is low or high, then you'll reach more of a steady state. But if the force is in between, then you'll get these oscillations, and you'll get this behavior, the limit cycle. So the idea is, at the beginning, when the egg chamber is small, this outward pressure is lower, and you're not getting these oscillations. And then when it gets to a certain size, then the force that's exerted from that is strong enough to cause these oscillations. And then when the egg chamber gets big enough, then the force gets great enough and the oscillations stop again. And those are all things that are observed. And so, yes. Yes, that's right. So it's a non-linear component that's fed in from the force that's exerted on the cell to the Rho kinase cycle. I think actomyosin, is sort of poised to oscillate. That's why we see all these different oscillations and all these different things. And this is one way to get it. And one way to get it is to have that nonlinear term. And in terms of the response of the Rho kinase pathway to the external pressure. Now, the interesting thing is, in many of these cases, the details of that. Like, how does that really work? How does this mechanical input actually activate Rho kinase? And that we don't know. And I think that's a really important open question in our field.
And before the egg chamber gets big enough, do the cells rotate in the model?
In the model. So that's actually sort of interesting, because the model does predict rotation. This is very intuitive. These are not synchronous contractions. So if there's any asynchrony in the contraction, it's going to create a torque, and the model does predict that. And so that's one possibility for how those rotations start to begin with, is that if there's some random myosin activity in the follicle cell layer, that could actually initiate the rotation.
But as it gets bigger, does it also explain why rotations stop?
That's a good question, and I don't know the answer. Does it explain why rotation stops? If it doesn't, we would need to fix that, because it does stop. So this model helps to explain why in the early phases we don't have oscillations exactly. In the myosin. And that at a particular phase, when the growth is such that the pressure gets to the right level, then you start to get these oscillations. And nicely, it explains why they start to happen in the center of the egg chamber, because the pressure will be greater at the center of this ovoid structure. And so that would explain why they start to, they initiate in the center. And then eventually the pressure gets great enough that they're happening everywhere. So that's sort of interesting. And what I personally looked at 10,000 gene expression patterns for different genes. And this is not a pattern of expression. This pattern of myosin accumulation is not something that you really ever see as a gene expression pattern. So we think that this is driven really by the geometry of the system and by the growth of the egg chamber, and the fact that the initial pressure will be greater in the center of this thing starts this whole process going, and that it's a case where the shape of this thing is not driven really by asymmetric gene expression patterns, but really by the asymmetry of the structure itself. So you could start to think about all more complicated, interesting geometries that you see in various different organs, and think about places where you have, strong constrictions and places where you don't. And we could wonder if these kinds of mechanisms also contribute to the shapes of those kinds of organs. So in this case, again, we think that symmetry. So how is symmetry broken here? Well, symmetry is broken, I guess, by the initial rotation around one axis. And ultimately, that is a function of the egg chambers forming and having stalks connecting each egg chamber to its neighbors. So ultimately, we've studied that process as well, and ultimately that is a function of asymmetry and morphogens and things like that, and more traditional patterning mechanisms. But once you have this round egg chamber anchored at each end, everything else happens as a consequence of the geometry and the forces involved. Okay, so I also want to tell you about this other process that happens during oogenesis and that we've spent a lot of time studying, which is the collective migration of this group of cells called the border cells. So the border cells start out as part of that follicle cell epithelium at the anterior end, but unlike all the rest of the follicle cells that remain in that epithelium for the entirety of oogenesis, the border cells actually extend protrusions in between the nerve cells and migrate about 150 microns until they reach the anterior border of the oocyte. And so we've been interested in this process because it's an example of collective cell-on-cell migration, and this is something that, especially in recent years, is probably the main mechanism by which a lot of different tumors end up spreading. Rather than spreading as individual cells, a lot of them spread as little clusters of cells. And so we're interested in this process. And so one big difference between cells that migrate as individual cells and cells that migrate as a group of cells is the presence of cell-cell adhesions and the impact of those cell-cell adhesions on the overall process of migration. So when cells migrate as individual cells, they eliminate their cell-cell adhesion molecules and they have to get rid of it. And the idea that's been in the literature about this is really that epithelial cells are, you can think of them as like bricks, and they're mortared together and they can't move. But if you dissolve the mortar, then you have individual cells and they're going to be more migratory. But when you think about groups of cells migrating, they aren't dissolving the mortar in between them there. And so the question we wanted to address in this study was whether they might actually be using E-cadherin-mediated cell-cell adhesion to promote their motility rather than needing to get rid of it to enable motility. So so here are the border cells about halfway through their migration in the egg chamber. Here's a high magnification view of E-cadherin expression in red and DAPI in blue. And there are a few things I want to point out. So the border cell cluster is actually composed of two completely different cell types, the central pair of cells, which don't migrate at all, and then they're surrounded by these other cells that are the ones that migrate, and they actually carry the central cells where they're going. And then they're migrating in between the nerve cells, which are out here. And so you can see a lot of cadherin in between the polar cells and border cells. You can see cadherin, why am I using this? Oh, yeah, this was the one that was working. But now I'm cursed. So we see a lot of cadherin here. We see some cadherin in between the individual border cells, and we think these are the residual adherence junctions that they had when they were part of the epithelium. And then we see a lot less cadherin at the border cell nerve cell junction, but we know that cadherin is important because if we genetically remove cadherin from the nerve cells, the border cells can't migrate. So we wanted to understand what the cadherin in these different places was doing and how it was contributing. We didn't know if cadherin was, let's say, contributing to the migration or impeding the migration, but they were overcoming it somehow. So we did some cell type specific RNAi experiments. So here we can remove cadherin by expressing an RNAi specifically in the polar cells, in the central cells, or specifically in the migratory cells, or specifically in the substrate, the nerve cells, and we can ask what happens. So if we remove cadherin from the migratory cells, you might have thought that what would happen is that the cells would fall apart, that you'd remove the mortar and now these individual cells would migrate, that the cells would break apart and migrate as individual cells. But in fact, what happens is they stay together as a cluster, but they migrate, they can't, they don't know the right way to go. So they migrate off to the side, something you would never, ever see in wild type. And then they sort of make their way back to the center, but they basically have trouble sensing directions. You'll also notice that relative to the wild type cells, they're not extending as many protrusions, and the protrusions are not as directional.
You know the guidance cue for this thing?
Yes, we do. And I'll mention it in a moment. So, so we don't have directional persistence. So that was not really the phenotype we were expecting. You'd expect the clusters to fall apart, and actually they do fall apart if you remove cadherin specifically from the central cells, the hub of this structure, then the clusters fall apart. So it's really the cadherin-mediated adhesion between the polar cells and the individual border cells that's holding this cluster together. So then this problem with sensing direction must come from the border cell nerve cell adhesion or border cell adhesion. So here we're just taking cadherin away from the nerve cells, not from the border cells themselves. And here it looks a little funny because we're focused on this surface because the cells are migrating along the surface. But again, they seem quite confused about what direction to move in. So they go one way and then they come back the other way, and they again have a problem sensing direction. So we can show that if we calculate a directionality index, we can show that if we overexpress cadherin in the nerve cells, you actually get a hyper, they're more directional. If we take away cadherin from the nerve cells, they're less directional than wild type. And if we take away cadherin from the migrating border cells, they're also less directional. So, so there's something about the border cell nerve cell cadherin interaction that's facilitating them being directional, and it's we can see this in a fixed image. We can see that a typical morphology of a wild type cluster would have a dominant forward directed protrusion and very little protrusion in the other directions. If we knock out cadherin, we get fewer, and the protrusions and the ones we have is juicier or shorter lived. But if we overexpress cadherin in the germline, we see this very exaggerated morphology, very long, stable protrusions. Yes.
What do you mean by protrusion? Is it a kind of lamellipod? What is it?
Yes, it's an actin-dependent extension of the cell. And we can, you know, if we want to objectively count them or whatever, we have to come up with criteria by which we define what's a protrusion. But it's basically an extension of the cell beyond, you know, you can see that the nucleus is close to the edge of the cell here, and it's far from the edge of the cell there. So, yeah?
Have you looked at the pattern of N-cadherin when you play with cadherin?
So in this system, these cells do not express N-cadherin while they're migrating. The other epithelial cells do express N-cadherin. So N-cadherin is not
Yeah, but when you remove E-cadherin, is it that re-express?
Oh, when we remove E-cadherin, does N-cadherin get re-expressed? We didn't look at that, actually. But yeah, I sort of, these cells specifically downregulate N-cadherin at this stage in development. But yeah, we didn't look at that actually. So so we were interested in the fact that E-cadherin seemed to be important for them to make directional protrusions and know what direction to move in, because cadherin itself is not asymmetric in this migrating cluster. I mean, it's asymmetric in the sense that you see more of it towards the center of the cell than the outside. But with respect to their direction of migration, we could not detect any difference in the distribution of cadherin. So we sort of wondered if there might be an asymmetry in the cadherin activity, like is the cadherin more adhesive, perhaps at the front of the cluster than at the back. And so to take a look at that, and this is what Boris and Madhav actually asked me to talk to you guys about, we used a fret-based tension sensor. So you might have heard of this already. In Martin Schwartz's lab, they developed it. And basically, the idea here is to take a blue fluorescent protein and a yellow fluorescent protein and put them on either side of a flexible domain from spider silk protein. And the features of this domain is that it stretches under low piconewton forces. And so the idea is that in the relaxed conformation, these two fluorofluorines are close enough together for you to get FRET so that you can excite with blue and read out yellow. And but that if you exert a force on this molecule, then it will stretch, and due to the distance dependence of the FRET, you'll lose the FRET. And so this is from their paper in 2010, showing a single molecule in a magnetic bead trap and showing the force-FRET relationship. So here we're looking at piconewton forces being exerted on this single molecule, and here you're watching the FRET go down and come up, and you can do repeated cycles of this, and it shows that there's no hysteresis in the system. So this seems to be a candidate for a molecular FRET sensor. And so they had put this sensor into vinculin and looked at it in cultured cells plated on fibronectin, and they could see differences in FRET reflecting higher tension, meaning lower FRET, on the molecules in focal adhesions on the protruding side of a moving cell, and lower tension, meaning higher FRET, on the retracting side of a moving cell. And you might think that that sounds completely obvious, but I don't think it was, because I think, although it was predicted based on other evidence, I think you could imagine that a cell is moving by sort of ripping up its adhesions, and you might have seen higher tension at the back of the cell, but that wasn't what they saw. So my student took this construct and cloned it into the Drosophila ecadherin gene. And so ecadherin on one cell, as you know, is binding ecadherin on the other. And he put it in between the transmembrane domain and the beta-catenin binding site. And the way that ecadherin interacts with the actin-actomyosin cytoskeleton is via this complex of beta and alpha-catenin. So in principle, when one cell is adherent to the other cell and the actomyosin cytoskeleton contracts, that's going to stretch this tension sensor. Now, this molecule can replace the function of endogenous ecadherin, and so flies can live perfectly happily if this is their only source of ecadherin. And so he made a control construct where he put the tension sensing module at the very C-terminus of the ecadherin molecule. So now we would say this is outside of the force transduction path. So you would think that when myosin contracts on this and exerts a force on this actin filament and exerts a force on ecadherin, probably this tension sensing module is not going to feel that. And this is an important control because we're going to be looking at small differences in FRET in a cell where there might be all kinds of things that are different in different parts of the cell. Maybe this should be independent of the concentration of this protein, so it shouldn't matter too much about that. But there could be other local differences inside of a cell with, let's say, other binding partners or the pH or, you know, who knows what that might be different. But this tension sensing module will be experiencing all of those same changes, but it won't be experiencing is the force of actomyosin pulling on it. So we could put these constructs into flies, and then we could look at migrating border cell clusters. And if we look at these clusters when they're extending protrusions, we can see, and we can take measure the FRET index at the front of the cell compared to the back of the cell, and we can take a ratio of the front to the back. And what we can see is that for the tension sensor, the front to back FRET ratio was less than 1. Whereas for the control tension insensitive construct, this ratio was much closer to 1. Okay, so someone asked about the guidance signals, and we do know in this system that there are multiple ligands that interact with two different receptor tyrosine kinases that function somewhat redundantly to guide the cells. Now you might ask, why do we need 4 ligands and 2 receptors to tell cells to go straight? And I don't know, but that's how it works. So the EGF receptor and PDGF receptor are expressed on all of the follicle cells. The ligands are expressed in the germline. And we know that these are important for the cell's descent direction. If we knock down the activities of the two receptor tyrosine kinases, the cells sort of protrude in all directions and have trouble sensing direction. And actually, the phenotype is similar in some ways in terms of their difficulty migrating on the right path. It looks a lot like the cadherin knockdown. Now, downstream of PVR and EGFR is a G protein called RAC. You've heard a lot about Rho, but yeah, I guess you've heard less about RAC in this course. But RAC is another Rho family GTPase whose function is to stimulate actin polymerization and lamellipodial protrusion, at least in cultured cells. RAC is essential for border cells to migrate, and in the absence of RAC, you don't get protrusions. And here what we're looking at is a RAC FRET activity probe. So this is a probe where the readout of FRET is a readout of how much RAC is in the GTP bound state. And we see reproducibly higher RAC FRET at the leading edge of the border cells that's protruding leading edge compared to the rest of the cluster. And if you knock down the activities of PVR and EGFR, you get a more uniform distribution of FRET. Of RAC FRET. So it looks like EGF receptor ligands and PVF impinge on these two receptor tyrosine kinases that then result in RAC activity, that then results in an asymmetry in RAC activity and an asymmetry in protrusion, which is important for the cells to migrate. Now, the puzzle in this system, or for any migrating cell for that matter, is that the concentration of chemoattractant, the difference in concentration of chemoattractant at the front and back of the cluster is going to be very small. In fact, we can't measure it. The receptor activity between the front and back of the cluster is going to be very small. And again, we can't measure it. But the morphology of the cluster is categorically different. And the direction of migration is always forward. It's not like it takes two steps forward and one step back. So the question is, how do you amplify this very small difference in chemoattractant concentration and receptor activity into a bigger difference in RAC activity and morphology and a complete, 100% difference in migration direction? So due to what we had seen with the E-cadherin phenotype and the E-cadherin tension sensor, we wondered if E-cadherin might be part of a signal amplification mechanism that would help us amplify the difference between the front and the back of the cluster. So the question for us then was, what happens to this asymmetry and tension on E-cadherin if we knock out the guidance receptors? So here's again this front-back FRET ratio on the cadherin tension sensor. It's less than one in wild type. If we look at, if we express the dominant negative receptors, then we lose the asymmetry on the cadherin tension sensor. So we also wondered if RAC activities, which we know is downstream of the receptors, would be required for this. And so now we can do the same experiment, but knock down RAC and ask what happens to the asymmetry on cadherin tension sensor. And so here is, again, the front-to-back FRET ratio. Here's wild type, and here's what happens in clusters expressing dominant negative RAC. We lose that asymmetry. But for something to be a feedback loop, we need an effect in the other direction. So we asked if E-cadherin is important for generating the asymmetry in RAC activity that we normally see. And so here, again, is the RAC activity probe that's asymmetric between the front and back of the cluster. And if we knock down cadherin, and here are just three different examples, then we lose the normal asymmetry of the RAC activity pattern. And so this, we think, is very consistent with the phenotype that we see, the cellular phenotype that we see, where the cells don't make big, long-lived protrusions. They don't make them uniformly in the right direction. And the whole cluster can migrate off to the side and change direction. It doesn't migrate persistently in one direction.
I don't know.
I presume the receptors, and of course cadherin, they're typically punctated along membranes. And do you find in the system that the receptors and cadherin sort of co-localize in puncta? So is there some, if they didn't, then it would be harder to explain the interaction. So I'm wondering if they co-localize.
We haven't looked at high resolution to ask if the puncta co-localize, but I'm not sure I agree that that would be a problem if they don't. So I guess we haven't thought it was a super important question because, you know, you could have local diffusion of these activities, right? So I think that they could interact, still be interacting at a biochemical level through a RAC-GEF and RAC-GTP and whatnot. I don't know that it's essential that they're in a physical complex with one another. But we actually haven't looked.
So one way of having no tension on the cadherin sensor would be to internalize it, I guess. And so when you look at differences in tension on cadherin at the front and back, is it always at the cortex? I mean, could it just be there's more internalized cadherin?
We haven't tried to get to that level of resolution in terms of spatially localizing the activity of the tension sensor to ask whether we were sort of averaging over areas and not really trying to distinguish between the cadherin that's on the membrane and the cadherin that's inside the cell. At a gross level, it's not like you see a lot on the membrane at the front, and this is all, you know, this is all taken into account. It's because it's a ratiometric number, it's taken into account the concentration of the protein. So it shouldn't be dependent on the concentration of the protein. But so if you just look, you won't see more cadherin at a steady state inside the cell at the back compared to the front. But the it could be internalized more rapidly. It could be something more rapidly. Okay.
So, okay, so we have a positive feedback loop then here between RAC and cadherin, but if we think about that in the context of the cell, we can think about the lead, and we're talking about what we think might be going on at the leading edge here, where each of these little symbols symbolizes a molecule, and so what I just told you is we know that, you know, the activity of these receptor tyrosine kinases stimulated by their ligands will activate exchange factors that activate RAC. This stimulates actin polymerization. I mean, we haven't shown it in this system, but that's just well established. Actin polymerization at the leading edge then generates a protrusive force. It generates new adhesions where the cell is extending and touching the nerve cells, and it generates tension either on the new adhesions or on the old adhesions. And through a mechanism that we don't fully understand yet, this leads to further RAC activity, more actin polymerization, et cetera, in a positive feedback loop. And this gives us that nice forward-directed dominant protrusion that frequently characterizes the morphology of a wild-type cluster. This mechanism could be as simple as cadherin on one cell ligating cadherin on another recruits an exchange factor. That's been observed in other like cultured cell systems. So this could be very simple, or it could be more complicated. We don't really know. But the problem here is that because the ligand concentration is not very different at the front compared to the back, and the receptor activity is not very different at the front compared to the back, in principle, this positive feedback loop should be going on everywhere, all around the cluster, and therefore you should have protrusion everywhere, and you still haven't solved the problem of how the cluster knows what direction to migrate in. So here, here we postulate, and we have evidence for the idea that it's cadherin in between these migrating cells that helps to connect, mechanically couple the cells to each other, so that when the lead cell gets a little advantage, because it has a little more ligand and a little more receptor activity, and starts to make that protrusion, it now yanks on the following cells, and thereby inhibits their ability to protrude and keeps everybody moving in the same direction. So we think of this sort of analogy of a team of dog sled team, where if these
animals were not mechanically connected to one another, they'd each be doing their own thing. But since they're mechanically coupled to one another, there's a lead dog and he's telling the other ones to follow him. And so we see the cadherin at these cell-cell junctions here as being like the harnesses that are connecting these dogs to each other. And we have evidence for that that was in this paper that was published. But basically, I wanted to point out to this group that I think the interesting question again comes to, how does this physical force get converted into a biochemical activity in the cell? So if we knock down cadherin from these individual cell-cell junctions, then we see that the cells now behave independently from one another, and each one protrudes in a different direction, and we see that we lose the asymmetry in RAC activity. But how does that happen? How does this cell sense a physical force and change RAC activity in response to that? So I think this is where I think there are a lot of interesting questions about how physical forces then ultimately impact on the biochemistry that's going on inside of the cell. Okay, so I'm going really fast, so I have a little more time to tell you another story. Yeah?
I have a question. You mentioned that it was 6 to 8 cells. Is it known what controls that variability?
The variability. Well, I don't know what controls the variability. I know what controls how do we get 6 cells out of 600 cells that are migratory and the other, the other cells are not. And what controls that is that these polar cells in the center secrete a cytokine that activates the JAK-STAT signaling pathway in the surrounding cells. And that signal is necessary and sufficient to determine the migratory population. So the variability in the number must have to do with variability in JAK-STAT signaling. And again, we have a similar situation where we have, ultimately there's a gradient of the ligand, there's a gradient of STAT activation, and at some point there's an on-off decision to migrate or to stay behind. So we have the same exact sort of situation where we need a positive and negative feedback loop or something to convert this graded information into discrete on and off states. Yeah.
Is there any idea of how mechanical feedback can go into the biochemistry at all?
So we can talk about this tonight when we talk about various types of FRET sensors of force, because that's a clue right there. So the force sensor, right, this spider silk protein domain stretches in response to mechanical force. And obviously, for it to be useful, it has to stretch more readily than the protein it's in that you're measuring the force on, right? So that spider silk domain has to be especially stretchy relative to the proteins that you're looking at. So there are, it is known that there are, that a certain amount of physical force will overcome a chemical bond or a protein. More likely, it takes less force to overcome the sort of non-covalent interactions that protein domains have when they're folding up. So there are some well-characterized examples of this, and vinculin is sort of one of them, and you've already heard about this protein, where the tail domain folds over on part of the protein, and in response to a physical force, that will unfold and reveal a binding site for another protein that comes in and binds to it. And this is a way that you get force, this is one way you can get force-dependent strengthening of an adhesion. So you yank on the adhesion, vinculin unfolds, tailing comes in and binds, you make it stronger, and repeat. And you can build, and you build focal adhesions this way. So very likely the answer is that the physical force pulls on a protein and maybe exposes binding sites so that, in our case, what we want to happen is you pull on a protein and you shut down RAC activity. So maybe you pull on the protein and you inactivate the exchange factor, or you activate the gap, or, I don't know, but I think that's the way we'd have to think about it. Or you could build complexes or take them apart with.
Question. So I see in your phenotypes when you down-regulate the cadherin, and you can see the cell to move straight if it's wild type, otherwise it starts to take like other direction, and you resume this by saying, oh, it goes straight or it doesn't go straight. Mm-hmm. But I feel that
these nerve cells create already a labyrinth, in the sense they're not infinite direction like new cells can take. They're maybe at the beginning only three, maybe at the surface, or maybe going through these nerve cells. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if these labyrinths are all the same, these pathways, or there are certain pathways, for instance, that are more echadery, because the straight one, it's probably where all nerve cells contact each other, probably, where there is more echadery.
You're right, and without a doubt, the nerve cell junctions and so on constrain the paths that the cells can take. The nerve cells actually express less cadherin on their surface than the other cells. So nerve cell junctions are going to actually have less cadherin than, let's say, a nerve cell follicle cell junction, because the follicle cells actually have a little bit more cadherin. The border cells have even more cadherin. They express the most of anybody. So there's also variability even just in wild type. You could have the border cells start at the very anterior tip of that structure, and they might happen to start right at a nerve cell junction. That's common, and then they just go straight. But in some egg chambers, there's just one nerve cell at the top, and the border cells form here, and they have to go over to the side a little bit to find the space in between the nerve cells, and they do that. They migrate this way for a little bit, and then they find the space in between the nerve cells, and they go. So they do seem to have an affinity for the interior of the egg chamber. So if that's an option for them, they prefer it to the exterior. But if it's not immediately available, they can look for it. They can go around the edges and look for the interior. But it's not the case that there's more cadherin in the interior. We don't know exactly these chemoattractant ligands. We haven't been able to see them, you know, outside of the cell, which is where the cell would see them, right? So we can't see the chemoattractants, and so we don't know. Maybe those accumulate more in between. Maybe, you know, the ligands for the receptor tyrosine kinases are accumulating more in between the nerve cell junctions, and that's what makes that space more attractive. We actually don't know. I mean, that would sort of make sense because all of the follicle cells express the receptors for those chemoattractants. So it's possible that they function as kind of a sink for the chemoattractants, and that then the chemoattractants accumulate in between our region. There can also be a physical component to this. So for example, we think that the extracellular matrix around the whole outside is pretty stiff for a variety of reasons, and that serves as a constraint as well on how big the cluster can be and how effectively they migrate.
Technical question. So do you see any difference in the sensitivity of the fret sensor to the temperature that you may be experiencing? That? Is it easier to hold it when the temperature goes up? Or
we have not tried to carefully look at that, but yeah. I'm trying to remember, because in the paper where they first characterized it, I mean, keeping in mind that this is a spider silk protein that's been used in mammalian cells and in Drosophila cells, hopefully it doesn't have a big temperature dependence.
Well, because the dynamic range might be different. Needed some dynamic range that you could tune the temperature.
Right, better. So one limitation of the spider silk protein is that its dynamic range is not very great. Maybe that's okay, because maybe the dynamic range that you need to sense is right there where it's sensitive. It's basically sensitive, so the fret goes to zero when the force on that domain is at 6 piconewtons, okay? So you can sense from 0 to 6 piconewtons, you can sense changes in fret. And of course, it's also a limitation that the fret changes are not huge. It's not like, you know, it's 25% changes in fret. It's not like huge changes in fret. So there are other sensor designs that might be better. But they have other limitations. So the great advantage of this one is that it's completely genetically encoded. So you can put it in a cell, put it in an animal. The other types of sensors that might have less, you know, might have a much bigger dynamic range or a much bigger fold change in fluorescence are unfortunately usually chemically synthesized, and so they can only be put outside of cells and stuff like that. So somebody needs to come up with one that has like a nice big dynamic range and a really big fold change that's genetically encoded. That would be helpful.
there are good models for this process in Dick Distilling going in and cyclically integrated that are fairly quantitative and also involve polarized limited pool of receptor.
Right.
Do you think those apply here, or can you exclude the that type of model?
Yeah, well, I can exclude the molecular nature of the model can't be the same. Conceptually, it might be the same. So, well, I mean, except that's also in an individual cell, right? So that's a model that, and it is the exact same question in an individual cell. It's even more acute within an individual cell because a cluster of cells can sense the gradient over 20 microns. An individual cell, especially in Dictyostelium, is sensing it over a much shorter distance than that. So you're absolutely right. There are good models there. And I was at Johns Hopkins for many years, and Peter Devriotis was one of my closest colleagues, so very familiar with those. And in that case, it's, you know, PI3 kinase goes to the leading edge and creates a lot of PIP3, and P10 goes to the trailing edge, and so there's a big difference in those phosphoinositides, and then that results in recruitment of specific proteins that have an affinity for those particular lipids. So in our system, you can constitutively activate PI3 kinase and it has no effect. So in what's asymmetric is going to be a little bit different. But it is interesting. We do see some striking phenomenological similarities. So if you take a Dictyostelium cell that's polarized, so you can obviously tell the front of the cell from the back of the cell. And you've got a cyclic AMP pipette and it's crawling towards it. And now you move the pipette, this polarized cell will keep the same leading edge and turn towards the pipette. But if you have a less polarized cell, just a round cell, and you move the pipette, it makes a new leading edge. We can show the same thing goes on in border cell clusters, whole cell clusters, if we can use a photoactivatable form of RAC. And if we take a not very polarized cluster and we photoactivate RAC, the cell with a photoactivatable RAC will become the lead cell. But if we take a polarized cluster with photoactivatable and we photoactivate RAC, the cluster will turn around and go. So there are interesting similarities and differences there. Yeah.
Isn't it also just to ask a comment on the fact that you're in this, you have the cellular environment around you, so ligands aren't sort of freely diffusing, and it's not how I think of Dictyostelium receptor, they're ligand. So I guess you've never been able to measure ligand concentration, right? Would it be possible that perhaps the gradient cells do crawl on gels that themselves have a stiffness gradient, so maybe the Q is mechanical. I don't know. I'm asking to. Yeah. So. Maybe.
Well, we would love to be able to see the extracellular ligands that the cells see, and we can't see them. So, we have an antibody against PVF1, and you can try to do the antibody staining on a live egg chamber so that you're not permeabilizing and you don't see all the stuff that's inside the cell, inside the cells, and then you see nothing. And if we were to express a GFP fusion protein, then we'd see all the stuff inside the cells and it would be hard to tell what was inside the cell and what was outside the cell. And so I guess it's been really hard to look at what is specifically outside of the cells. And you can do the staining on the whole thing and you can deduce that maybe what's outside of the cells is proportional to what's inside the cells, you know, and so then you kind of do see a gradient inside the cells, but we just don't know what that means. Could the path itself be providing a mechanical cue? Well, I think because when we knock out the receptors, we lose direction sensing. I think you need both. I think it's clear that if you take away cadherin, you lose direction sensing. If you take away the ligands, you lose, or the receptors, you lose direction sensing, and so I think it's the combination of both, and I guess seems reasonable to me. Okay, I'm just going to tell you something that we discovered recently, and I don't know if this crowd is really interested in this or not, but I think it's kind of cool. So there's been this long-standing mystery of a whole class of proteins that are phenomenally important inside of your body and that arthropods lack. all arthropods, and of course arthropods outnumber all other animals, and so this is quite remarkable. In your body, you have about 70 different types of cytoplasmic intermediate filaments: neurofilaments, nestin, vimentin, keratin, a lot of different intermediate filaments, and some of these perform functions like protecting your skin from blistering. So there are skin blistering diseases, for example, caused by mutations in keratin. And you can imagine that if you're an arthropod and you have an exoskeleton, maybe you don't need a keratin so much. But there are all kinds of these intermediate filament proteins which provide mechanical stability to cells and determine the diameters of axons and neurons and stuff. And, you know, here are all these animals that seem to lack them completely. And so this has been a little bit mysterious. And so what I want to tell you about is a protein that we found that we think might serve some of the functions of cytoplasmic intermediate filaments in flies. So this project really started in territory that you'll be very comfortable with, and that is thinking about actin-myosin complexes. And the idea that actin and myosin do everything interesting in morphogenesis, and yet, and this incredible variety of things that actin and myosin do, and yet they're encoded by this handful of very highly conserved proteins, and so there's not a lot of diversity in the proteins themselves. So where does the diversity come from in terms of what actin and myosin do in cells? So probably it comes from where you decide to put your rack and row proteins, but we were thinking about this protein called tropomyosin, which everybody who works on actin and myosin doesn't seem to really think about very much. But tropomyosin is a protein that wraps around actin filaments and modulates the interaction of myosin with actin filaments. You've probably heard of it most commonly in the context of muscle, but non-muscle cells also have tropomyosins. And in fact, here's a source of potential variation, because you can see here that in a mammalian genome, you'll have about 44 spliced isoforms of tropomyosin encoded from four different genes, which is a little daunting to think about working on. We got interested in tropomyosin because both border cells and the oscillating follicle cells express and require tropomyosin function. And we thought, well, maybe these two different cell types that do very different things with their actin-myosin cytoskeletons, maybe they use different forms of tropomyosin to do that. That turns out to be wrong, but something else turns out to be right, so it's okay. So if we look at the isoforms of tropomyosin encoded in the Drosophila genome, Drosophila actually has two tropomyosin genes. This is one of them, and there are potentially 17 different spliced isoforms. And we were able to profile which ones are expressed in follicle cells, and it turns out that there are just three that are normally expressed in follicle cells. This one called L, this one called A, and you can notice that L and A have a lot of exons in common. They share all of these exons right here. They're almost the same, they just differ a little bit at the N terminuses, and I'll show you they function redundantly, but that's maybe not surprising. Then there's this isoform, I'm just having bad luck with pointers today, this isoform here, and this one only shares this one light blue exon with the rest of them. So this tropomyosin isoform is different. Thank you. You change the battery? You carry batteries with you?
Yeah, let's see.
Okay. Well, I wonder if I'm like doing something that's killing batteries today. I don't know. Okay. So these two isoforms that share a lot of sequence in common, a defining feature of tropomyosins, every tropomyosin that's ever been characterized, is an end-to-end coiled protein. And so here's a prediction program called COILS, and you can predict the probability that something is going to form a coiled coil. And these isoforms A and L, like every other known tropomyosin isoform, is predicted with a probability of one forming a coiled coil from one end to the other. The other isoform, I, has a region of coiled coil, but it also has N and C terminal domains that have a probability of zero of being a coiled coil. Okay, so what do these different isoforms of tropomyosin do? And what I'll tell you is that the conventional canonical tropomyosins A and L accumulate on these stress fibers that you're now very familiar with. And they're required for these stress fibers to form. And that makes sense. They're probably required in the way that tropomyosins generally are for recruitment of myosin. And it's an amplifying mechanism where when the myosin gets recruited to the stress fiber, it contracts on it, and this builds a bigger stress fiber. Okay, so if we remove either one alone, nothing happens. But here's a section of follicle cells that have that are expressing RNAi's for both A and L. And this is an antibody that recognizes both of those proteins. And you can see that those cells don't express A and L. The cells are there. They're perfectly happy. But they don't express A and L. And this is phylloidin staining. They also don't accumulate stress fibers. Well, that's a very normal thing for tropomyosin to do. The unusual isoform of tropomyosin, though, is required actually in every cell type that we looked at. It's required in the border cells for them to migrate. It's required in the outer follicle cells. And it's even required in the germline. So you've heard a lot about the germline from Trudy, and you know about the localization of different RNAs and proteins in the oocyte. You know that Gherkin gets localized over here. Well, at the posterior pole of the germline is a very special region of cytoplasm called the germplasm. And that's where the posterior determinants, nanos and so on, Oscar and all of those guys are. And you probably already heard about all of this. But anyway, so in the germplasm, this unusual isoform of tropomyosin accumulates. This is an antibody against all the other isoforms. And that does not recognize the germplasm. But this this unusual isoform of tropomyosin is in the germplasm. And Anna Ferruzzi had shown a number of years ago that that mutating the tropomyosin locus resulted in a lack of Oscar RNA localization, and so a total lack of germplasm. But it wasn't clear which isoform was required. And she has come across the same observation, that it's this unusual isoform of tropomyosin that's required in the germline for the germplasm. And what we can see is that it's the only one that's there. So it has to be the one that's required. Okay, so we were wondering, what is this unusual isoform of tropomyosin? And so we started to look in the protein regions that are not coiled-coil and ask, what's there? And so it turns out that those regions are composed of protein domains that have a high probability of being intrinsically disordered. So this is a protein, this is a structure prediction program that tells you the probability of disorder. And you can see that in the N-terminal region and the C-terminal region, this protein has domains that are predicted to be intrinsically disordered. And they're made up of these low complexity sequences. Lots of simple amino acid repeats and whatnot. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, I mean, I don't know how familiar all of you are with this idea, but we all learn that proteins are, you know, strings of amino acids, and they have one low energy conformation, and that's the functional conformation. And if you denature them in guanidinium hydrochloride and then dialyze that away, that they're going to fold back up into that one stable state. And that turns out to be true for about 50% of the human proteome. But the other 50% is different from that. And it's composed of these domains of either low complexity sequence or intrinsically disordered proteins, and those are not identical, but they sometimes can be in the same domain. And I was very intrigued by a seminar that I heard from Steve McKnight, who then published these two beautiful papers showing that low complexity sequence domains can form in vitro. They can form fibers and fibrous and hydrogels. They can actually gel, okay? And they were studying them in the context of cell-free formation of RNA protein granules. And so I'll just quote from their paper that low complexity sequences can undergo a concentration-dependent phase transition to a hydrogel-like state. They did X-ray diffraction and EM studies to reveal that the hydrogels are composed of uniformly polymerized amyloid-like fibers. But unlike pathogenic amyloid fibers that you've heard about, these low-complexity sequence polymers are dynamic and accommodate heterotrophic polymerization And so they propose that this offers a framework for understanding low complexity sequences and possibly an organizing principle for cell structures that are not membrane bound. So they're thinking of them as forming RNA protein granules. Yes?
So what's low complexity sequences?
So low complexity sequences means you're not using the 20 amino acids. So the 20 amino acids that we have a distribution. Some are common, some are rare, but you'll find them. In these low complexity sequences, you're really only using a handful of amino acids, and you're using them in simple little repeated motifs. They're not even motifs. They're just, it looks kind of random. Okay, so that had to do with RNA protein granules, but I'm really thinking about the cytoskeleton. So what does this have to do with the cytoskeleton? And you can find that there's actually a lot of these intrinsically disordered domains in cytoskeletal proteins, actually. And the one that caught our eye was actually the inner, well, not the one, but the family of intermediate filament proteins. Because their structure is that they're composed of central coil and coil domains that are flanked by N and C terminal intrinsically disordered domains. And these intermediate filaments can't make anything bigger than a tetramer without their disordered domains. The disordered domains interact end to end and make filaments and then stick out side to side and mediate the spacing between the protofilaments into the intermediate filaments. So intermediate filaments are called intermediate because they're intermediate in diameter between actin, which is about 8 nanometers, an actin filament is about 8 nanometers, and a microtubule is about 25. And intermediate filaments are 8 to 12. So that's why they're called intermediate. Okay, so because our weird isoform of tropomyosin had a coiled coil and it was flanked by these intrinsically disordered domains, we wondered if it could form intermediate-like filaments. So here we collaborated with Masato Kato at UT Southwestern, who's been working with Steve McKnight, and he expressed our protein and used the polymerization conditions that are normally used for neurofilaments, one form of cytoplasmic intermediate filament. And here's what he got. He got these filaments that are 13 to 16 nanometers in diameter. So by Wien criterion, they're intermediate between actin and microtubules, so we could call them an intermediate filament. But they're clearly not. The protein is not homologous to intermediate filament proteins. And that whole family shares certain sequence features that they're very, very divergent from one another. So they don't, you know, they don't align sequence-wise that well. But they do have certain features that are conserved. And this protein does not have those features. So it's not an intermediate filament protein, but it is a protein that can form filaments that are intermediate in diameter between actin and microtubules. And we further showed that if we remove the head domain, the N-terminal domain, it still forms filaments. If we remove the tail domain, it doesn't form filaments. And if we just take the tail domain fused to GFP, it will form a filamentous structure by itself. These are not the same filaments as these. These filaments are this beta amyloid type of structure, which was shown with X-ray diffraction and so on.
How do you get it to line up, or are they lining up? Head to tail is only the head. Wait, just the tail line.
Yes. Well, they don't have the tail, so
they don't have the tail,
this could be, yeah. So if I don't know exactly what they're doing, but if they're doing something like the intermediate filaments, the intermediate filament proteins, yeah. So here, it's actually only one domain. It's the opposite of ours, but it's only blue to blue that's giving you the filament formation. It's green to green here is giving you some spacing, okay? But it's only blue to blue that's giving you the filaments.
And the lateral interactions put another blue lens on the bottom.
Yeah, so these are, right, these are anti-parallel dimers, but yeah. So then the question was, well, okay, that's fine. They can make filaments in a test tube, but do they form filaments in cells? And so here, my student had to, really play with the buffer and fixation conditions because different conditions either preserve actin or preserve microtubules or preserve intermediate filaments, and you don't know a priori what's going to work. But anyway, she was able to find buffer and fixation conditions that preserve. This is an M-cherry knock-in to this particular isoform of tropomyosin. So it's expressed from the endogenous locus at endogenous levels and it's replacing the endogenous gene. And you can see these beautiful filaments. This is actually in the oocyte. This is a ring canal connecting the nerve cells to the oocyte. And the point of that is that this is not co-localizing with F-actin. Traditional tropomyosin completely co-localizes with F-actin. This doesn't co-localize at all with F-actin that we can tell. It does, however, co-localize with microtubules. And so that's actually kind of interesting because you could think, and it's known that, for example, neurofilaments co-localize with microtubules in axons and facilitate the interaction of microtubule motors with microtubules. And so that's kind of the analogous function to tropomyosin with actin, because tropomyosin interacts with actin and mediates the interaction of myosin with actin. And now here are proteins that align along microtubules, and Anna Frusi has evidence that this isoform is important for the interaction between kinesin and the microtubule and Oscar RNA. So this study raises really a lot of questions, but basically what we think evolution has done is take the a little bit of coiled coil from tropomyosin, stick some intrinsically disordered domains on either end of it, and made something that looks a little bit like an intermediate filament protein. And this protein is capable of making filaments that are clearly not the same as intermediate filaments, but have more in common with intermediate filaments than they have in common with traditional tropomyosin. And so, anyway, that's kind of fun. Now, this isoform of tropomyosin, we can find it throughout all the different flies, and then we lose it, so it's not in all arthropods. But this gives us a kind of search motif that we could go look for proteins that maybe have a high probability of forming filaments if they're composed of coil-coil domains flanked by disordered domains, and both of those are simple predictions, so it's really just a matter of writing a program to look for those things. Okay, so I am just going to acknowledge some people. This was the tropomyosin story is the thesis work of Ari Cho with a lot of help from the undergraduate Tess and our collaborators at UT Southwestern. And that's just a lead from the lab. But anyway, I can stop there and take any more questions you might have.
The tropomyosin that you're polarizing in vitro, do you know that it's head to tail, or do you know anything about the orientation of what the substructure is like in the filament?
We do not know that yet. Yeah.
And if you get rid of microtubules and look at the filaments, or vice versa, is there any dependence one direction or the other?
So if we get rid of this isoform of tropomyosin, we don't see a problem with microtubules, and we don't see any kind of global disorganization of the cell. We don't see any kind of apical basal polarity problems. So, but I think, as I mentioned to you before, but in the outer follicle cells, we lose the basal stress fibers and we lose the localization of the traditional tropomyosins to that part of the cell. So they haven't lost apical basal polarity, but they lose the ability to localize the traditional tropomyosins. The proteins don't localize together at all, the traditional tropomyosins and this one. So we don't fully understand that, but you know, you can find papers that say that intermediate filament proteins do that too. So you can remove vimentin from a certain type of, I can't remember now, maybe an astrocyte or something like that, and the focal adhesions don't form anymore. So, yeah.
In the cells that you showed the beautiful network of filaments, can it form filaments if there aren't microtubules? Does it form another kind of filament, do you think?
I don't know the answer to that. When we treat with colchicine, we see changes in the filament network, but we haven't characterized it really well yet. So, yeah, it's an interesting question. In fact, what would be kind of fun would be to put the microtubules together with the protein in vitro and see what happens. Yeah.
So, going back to the migration problem, so the fact that we disrupt the nerve cell capturing, then you lose the directionality. Does that suggest that mechanical feedback is essential, or there can be alternative mechanisms at play?
I think it's Well, okay, so when we take cadherin away from the nerve cells, I think there are probably two things that we're doing. One is that we're not giving them the mechanical feedback that they need to make their big forward-directed protrusion, but we're also, you know, reducing their traction on that surface, right? So because we think this is their major adhesion molecule that they use for migrating. So we're doing two things when we take cadherin away from the nerve cells. How we can disrupt mechanical feedback more specifically is actually by doing it within the border cell cluster itself. So now we can knock out cadherin from a subset of the border cells. Okay, I didn't show this experiment, but it's in the paper. So you can knock out cadherin from a subset of the border cells, and then the lead cell can't communicate with the following cells, even though the lead cell still has traction with the nerve cells, can still extend a protrusion normally and all of that, but now you've lost the communication with the following cells. And so that's why we think the mechanical feedback is important for communicating direction from the lead cell to the following cells.
But when you say that if you reduce the border cell adhesion, isn't it just the, like you said, disrupting the integrity so that where you make an analogy of that?
They don't fall apart. Like the cluster doesn't fall apart. So it's not like they're really not, you know, close enough to do anything else they would do with one another other than communicate through cadherin. You know, so it's not like the cells start falling off the cluster now and you can't tell if that's why they're not moving together. So the cluster does still stay together and you just you lose this communication of directional information. Yep.
So if you just see some sort of back of the envelope calculation about how many cadherins you must have in those cells and how much tension is on each one, and then if you add them all up, is that a sort of plausible number for pulling on a cell and changing its shape, or do you think that there has to be some kind of signal?
No idea. We have not tried to calculate molecules or even force per molecule. Now, in principle, the tension sensor can tell you force per molecule. In practice, they're apparently, you know, when people use different methods for doing this, they get somewhat different answers, but, you know, within a factor of two or so maybe it's okay. And so the tension per molecule is something like, you know, 4 piconewtons. But I don't know how many molecules there are, and I don't know how I would even make a back of the envelope calculation as to how many molecules there are, especially if you consider that within a border cell, the distribution of E-cadherin molecules is very asymmetric. So if I'm a border cell, I've got most of my E-cadherin on the polar cell side, and some in an adherence junction, and some along the lateral edge, and then less at the border cell nerve cell. So you'd have to do it with fluorescence. If you were going to do it, you'd have to do it by fluorescence. But yeah, I wouldn't know how to start to count this. But if somebody else knows how to do that. Oh, it's time to go. Yes. But I did end on time.
Yeah, no, it was excellent. I really recommend it. Yeah,